Since the famous book and film Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky has stirred up debate about the role of propaganda in the corporate democratic system. In May 2007, Chomsky spoke again at a conference organized by the University of Windsor. The event was 20 Years of Propaganda, and the speech was The Poison Chalice, the Media, and the Use of Force. Chomsky describes how the media hides war crimes when we commit them, and compares American behavior to the standards of the Nuremberg war crimes trials of top Nazi leaders. Here is Noam Chomsky.
The words of the title, which are perhaps familiar, are borrowed from U.S. Justice Robert Jackson. He was the chief of counsel for the prosecution at the Nuremberg Tribunal, these are drawn from his address to the tribunal on the principle of universality, that is the foundation of any moral code that can be taken seriously. It's the principle that we apply to ourselves, the same standards that we apply to others, if not more stringent ones. Justice Jackson admonished the tribunal that this elementary principle must be their guide, or else its proceedings will be nothing but legal farce, an act of vengeance, victor's justice. So to quote Jackson's memorable words, if certain acts of violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them. And we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others, which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poison chalice is to put it to our own lips as well. The judgments of Nuremberg were incorporated into contemporary international law as founding principles, and although the tribunal was seriously and admittedly flawed, it's regularly invoked as the precedent and the standard for subsequent tribunals up until today, which are presented as high-minded efforts to approach the standards of Nuremberg, invariably falling short. One fundamental reason for their failure and their profoundly immoral character is that the principle of universality is universal in only one crucial respect. It's universally rejected with scarcely any departure. Worse, the rejection is scarcely, if ever, even noticed. So deeply ingrained is the doctrine that we are immune to fundamental moral and legal principles. The poison chalice has never approached the lips of the powerful, neither crimes. And one of the tasks of the media is to see that result. Worse still, this is considered right and just, or more accurately, is routinely concealed in a display of self-praise, tainted only by the recognition of failure and incompetence, which is reminiscent of concerns of the Nazi high command after Hitler made the foolish error of opening a two-front war. And that is regrettably all too accurate a portrayal of the stance of the intellectual culture, the media in particular, with regard to the blood that's on our hands from Nuremberg to the present day. Actually, that ugly outcome was foreseen by the more acute participants in the Nuremberg proceedings, and notably Telford Taylor, who was Jackson's chief counsel for war crimes. The central crime addressed by the Nuremberg Tribunal, of course, was the crime of launching aggressive war. Quoting Taylor before the trials, he said, "This phase of the case is based on the assumption that it is or will be declared a punishable offense to plan and launch," and and he interpolated and lose, question mark, an aggressive war. His question and lose was quickly proven to be all too appropriate. So the crime is to lose an aggressive war. In retrospect, Taylor described Justice Jackson's instructions to the tribunal as beautiful words, but did the results match the aspiration? It's a rhetorical question, as he intended. The results could not have undermined the aspiration with more force and cruelty. Aggression in the tribunal's judgment, quoted, is the supreme international crime, differing from others only in that it encompasses all of the evil that follows. All means all. So in Iraq, the crime of aggression encompasses the savage destruction of Fallujah, sectarian violence, death squads, the desperate flight of 2 million people, displacement of 2 million others, and the rest of the horrors of the past few years that are too familiar to review, with the aggressors absolved from blame, except in marginal respects, in keeping with the conventional refusal to sip from the poisoned chalice. There was no ambiguity in the definition of the supreme international crime. In Justice Jackson's opening statement to the tribunal, he defined an aggressor as a state that is the first to commit such actions as invasion of its armed forces with or without a declaration of war of the territory of another state. Very clear. There's actually more to which I'll return. But this provision holds unambiguously for the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, which is the leading issue on the international agenda today and by far the greatest concern of Americans, according to regular polls. Well, there is vigorous debate about Iraq, but it's within strict limits, which are familiar, for example, from the debate on Vietnam for many years. Iraq is often compared to Vietnam. A comparison that is accurate in one respect only, namely how the war is perceived by the aggressors. Almost every other respect is radically different. Particularly instructive, as always, is the interpretation of the doves at the extreme critical end of the admissible spectrum. These are the guardians of permissible thought. In both cases, Vietnam and Iraq, the doves condemn the war as a quagmire, too costly to us. Quote one representative example from Vietnam, the way out at the extreme of critical commentary. At the war's end, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis explained that U.S. intervention began with blundering efforts to do good, but by 1969, most people realized that it was a disastrous mistake that the U.S. could not impose a solution except at a price too costly to itself. 1969 was a year after corporate America had called for the enterprise to be liquidated, the U.S. having attained its basic goals. 1969 was 2 years after the highly respected military historian and Vietnam specialist Bernard Fall warned that Vietnam as a cultural and historic entity is threatened with extinction, while in the South, which is always the main target of U.S. aggression in Vietnam, in the South, the countryside literally dies under the blows of the largest military machine ever unleashed on an area this size. But at the liberal, dovish end of the spectrum, it was becoming too costly to us. That's as far as you could go. But not the population, however, the U.S. population. By 1969, 70% of the U.S. population regarded the war, quoting, not a mistake, but fundamentally wrong and immoral. Those figures have remained pretty constant to the present, pretty remarkable because everyone reaches that conclusion on their own. The words are unpronounceable in the mainstream. Well, to mention one other case, preeminent liberal American historian and Kennedy advisor Arthur Schlesinger at first supported the Kennedy-Johnson aggression, adopting the virtually universal stance. There was no objection to that. But 4 years after Kennedy launched the direct aggression, Schlesinger was having second thoughts, and he wrote, "We all pray that the Hawks will be right, and that sending more troops will bring us victory. And if the surge of that day works, we may all be praising the wisdom and statesmanship of the American government in winning victory in a tragic country gutted and devastated by bombs, a land of ruin and wreck." But he doubted that it would work, so he was at the dovish extreme. And he therefore added, "No thoughtful American can withhold sympathy as President Johnson ponders the gloomy choices that lie ahead." That is, sympathy for the president, but not his victims. And the translation to the present moment is perfectly straightforward with a few changes of names. It's what you read today in the papers. Well, it's kind of significant that Schlesinger's position on the Iraq War was radically different. As the bombing of Iraq began, March 2003, he recalled the words of President Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor, and he wrote that the bombing of Baghdad II is a date which will live in infamy. Roosevelt's famous words at Pearl Harbor, "The bombing is a date that will live in infamy as the U.S. embraces the policies of Imperial Japan." That was a lone voice in the mainstream. Schlesinger died a few months ago, and he was greatly honored, but not for this statement, which has been effectively dispatched to the memory hole. The prevailing attitudes about Iraq, the Iraq aggression, are much, as in the case of Vietnam, benign and intent by definition, but becoming too costly to us as a result of the incompetence and the errors of the political leadership. Justice Jackson's principle of universality is not even a faded presence. Also gone from history and media coverage is Washington's torture of the Iraqi people in earlier years, from the CIA-sponsored coup of 1963, certainly backed, probably initiated by the CIA. That's the coup that laid the basis for the rule of Saddam Hussein, a rule which Washington strongly supported from virtually its outset. As you all know, Saddam was hanged for crimes that he committed in 1982, crimes that were minor by his standards, only 150 people killed. With impressive discipline, the media and commentators failed to notice that 1982 was an important year in U.S.-Iraq relations. It was in 1982 that President Reagan removed Iraq from the list of states supporting terrorism so that the U.S. could begin to provide Saddam with substantial aid, including means to develop weapons of mass destruction. To firm up the deal, Reagan sent his special emissary to Baghdad named Donald Rumsfeld. Along with others, the U.S. and U.S.-British support for Saddam continued without a break, right through his most horrendous crimes, and long after the end of the war with Iran. In 1989, the Bush administration, first Bush administration, invited three Iraqi scientists to attend a detonation conference in Oregon, where they learned from experts all over the world how shockwaves detonate nuclear weapons. In short, they were being trained in advanced means to develop nuclear weapons. In December 1989, Bush was sending materials that the Iraq regime could use for nuclear, missile, and chemical purposes. Actually, I'm quoting from congressional records, not from the press, which has kept this far removed from sight for 15 years now. In April 1990, Bush sent a high-level senatorial delegation to Iraq, led by Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, later Republican presidential candidate. Their mission was to bring President Bush's greetings to his friend Saddam and to assure him of U.S. support. Well, 4 months after the Bush mission, Saddam invaded Kuwait, either disobeying or misunderstanding orders. That's a real crime. That shifted him from the category of honored friend to embodiment of evil. The invasion of Kuwait was indeed a crime, though not by Saddam standards, or for that matter by U.S. standards. A few months earlier, the United States invaded Panama, vetoing a couple of Security Council resolutions and killing probably thousands of mostly poor people, according to the victims, more than died in Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, though we don't know the details, because it's a firm principle of international affairs and moral culture that the victors do not permit investigation of their own crimes, so we only have the victims' reports. Well, those were the early days of U.S. torture of Iraqis, which continued without a break. At the time of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, American public opinion was strongly in favor of a diplomatic solution, a solution which would combine Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait with international negotiations to settle the regional crisis. That's actually pretty much what Saddam had proposed, though the media politely withheld the information, except for one newspaper, Newsday, which is a suburban newspaper near New York on Long Island. It's kind of an interesting fact that right throughout the buildup to the war, officials in Washington were leaking information to Newsday, which it published. The U.S.-British attack devastated Iraqi civilian society, which it was aimed at, and it was followed by a return of support for Saddam Hussein as he then turned to the slaughter of the Shiites to suppress an uprising that probably would have overthrown him had he not been effectively authorized by Washington to crush him. And the reasons were not suppressed. They were frankly acknowledged. New York Times Mideast correspondent Alan Cowell, still with the Mideast correspondent, he explained that there is a strikingly unanimous view among the United States and its allies, Britain and Saudi Arabia, that Saddam offered the West and the region a better hope for his country's stability than did those who have suffered his repression. So we therefore unhappily have to support Saddam's crushing of the rebellion. I'll return to the interesting concept stability, which is regularly invoked today too. Well, at that point, the task of torturing Iraqis was turned over to Bill Clinton. That's the sanctions regime, which was so visibly murderous that by 1996 it was felt necessary to introduce a humanitarian modification. That's the oil for food program, which magnanimously permitted Iraq to use a fraction of its own resources to save its own population from total destruction, though in sharply limited ways, carefully controlled by the United States and Britain. The first director of the program, a distinguished international diplomat, James Halliday, Irish, he resigned in protest after 2 years, condemning the program as genocidal. Notice that's the humanitarian program. He condemned it as genocidal and resigned. He was replaced by another highly respected international diplomat, Hans von Sponeck, German. He also resigned after a couple of years, charging that the Clinton-Blair administration of the sanctions violated the Genocide Convention. Their well-documented charges are scrupulously ignored by those who posture grandly about genocide when they detect crimes of some official enemy, not on that scale. Halliday and Pansponi were iced out of the U.S. media during the build-up to the 2003 invasion, although, or perhaps because, they knew more about Iraq than any other Westerners. Or perhaps it's because the media agreed with the official Clinton State Department position when it blocked Pansponi's efforts to bring the grisly record to the Security Council. Their phrase was, "This man in Baghdad is paid to work, not to talk." And that was Clinton's State Department, so he can't inform the Security Council. Well, he does talk, however. And in free societies like ours, we're lucky to be able to read Pansponi's detailed and devastating account of the effect of the genocidal sanctions and the Clinton-Blair role in ensuring their brutality. His book, called A Different Kind of War, appeared last year. It's one of those books that is too important to be reviewed or mentioned. A recent database search a couple days ago found not a single mention of it in the United States, and in England, a single review in the Morning Star. Not exactly mainstream. Robert Fisk also brought it up in the Irish press. Apparently that's the only English language mention. It's easy, quite easy, however, to find ample praise for Tony Blair's profound moral convictions as he stepped down from office a few days ago. I'm sure you've read many of these accolades. The crimes I mentioned are only a small part of the ugly story, for Clinton even more so. Well, we can find out something about the effects of the Clinton-Blair sanctions, at least obliquely, if you read closely. So a couple of weeks ago, the media did report that Iraq has suffered the worst increase in child mortality of any country on record. If you look at the small print, you'll notice that is since 1990. That is, as a result of the sanctions regime and the war. And for the liberal hawks, a retrospective justification for the war after the failure to find weapons of mass destruction is that at least it rid the country of a brutal regime. That has the merit of being half true. It rid the country of two brutal regimes, Saddam Hussein's and the sanctions regime, which apparently killed far more Iraqis than Saddam, but only one of them is mentionable. Also unmentionable is the belief expressed by Halliday and Pansponi that if Clinton and Blair had permitted Iraqi society to revive, Iraqis themselves might have dealt properly with Saddam's tyranny, and probably sending him to the same fate as a series of other vicious tyrants, many quite comparable to him, supported by the United States and Britain to the last days of their bloody rule. Ceausescu, Suharto, Marcos, Duvalier, long rogues gallery of others, to which new names are added regularly. None of this arousing any thoughts about our innate, benign intentions to do good. Well, the outcome in Iraq, as you certainly know, is an unmitigated disaster. It's not surprising that last year, according to State Department polls, two-thirds of people in Baghdad wanted the United States to leave immediately. Large majorities elsewhere wanted the United States to withdraw within a year, which would mean within the next few months, and a vast majority felt that the presence of U.S. forces increases the level of violence. 60% regarded U.S. forces as legitimate targets of attack. But these figures include Kurds, and they're much higher in the Arab areas where the troops are actually deployed. These figures have been rising steadily for some time and are presumably higher by now. Well, the U.S. public largely agrees. It, by a large majority, favors a firm timetable for withdrawal. The government reaction is escalation, the surge. The Democratic majority has proposed alternatives, but they're pretty pallid. Even the one that was vetoed. There's a useful analysis by General Kevin Ryan, who's now at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He suggests that the Democratic proposal should not be called withdrawal, but rather remissioning. The reason is that when you look at them closely, there's a national security exemption, meaning, as Bush says, this national security is at stake, do what you like. There's an exemption for combating international terrorism. It's also an open door. Troops are going to stay for training and for facilities and force protection. There's a tacit premise which underlies all public discussion about Iraq across the spectrum and other places too. The premise is we own the world. That's unmentionable, unnoticed, and on that assumption, you don't collapse in ridicule when you're on any other assumption. Actually, that illustrates rather neatly a crucial difference between propaganda systems in totalitarian states and in democratic societies. In a totalitarian state, the party line is usually announced clearly and explicitly, and you better repeat it and say it when you're asked, or you get sent to the gulag or the torture chamber or something. You don't have to believe it. You just have to repeat it. That's a totalitarian system. In democratic societies, that doesn't work. The state has lost the capacity to control the population by violence. So therefore, the propaganda line somehow has to be believed or internalized. So what you do in a democratic society is you never articulate the party line. You never see an editorial saying, we own the world, so therefore we're not foreign anywhere. That would be a bad mistake. It's like Stalin. What you do is just presuppose it. You presuppose the party line, never say it, and then you encourage a vigorous debate within the framework established by the party line. So that gives the impression that the society is free and open, and it also helps instill the party line. Because you can't even carry out the debate unless you accept it, like foreign forces. So it just becomes like the air you breathe, and you accept it. It's the way the world is. That's democratic propaganda. Plenty of illustrations. Just take one more. And take the surge. As soon as George Bush announced the surge in opposition to public opinion in the U.S. and, of course, Iraq, you can predict at once that it's going to be accompanied by charges of Iranian interference, which it was. So immediately we have charges of Iran interfering in Iraq. And then there comes a debate, a vigorous debate. The hawks say, yeah, that Iran's interfering, let's blast it. The doves say, well, you know, I'm really not sure, maybe those roadside bombs, you didn't read the serial numbers correctly, maybe it's just the Revolutionary Guards, not the government. And you have a debate about that. The debate is totally senseless, except on the assumption that we own the world. You could not have a debate in, say, 1943 in Germany about whether the Allies were interfering in occupied Europe, say in Vichy France. I mean, maybe in Nazi Germany could have a debate, but certainly not anywhere else. People collapse in ridicule. It was under military occupation. How can anybody be interfering? But we live in a democratic society, and so therefore you can carry out the sort of effective propaganda which allows this debate to go on without ridicule. That's a tribute to our capacity to be controlled by government, media, propaganda. universally, just about, and try to find some comment about all this. Just take for granted.
You are listening to the keynote speech by Noam Chomsky, delivered May 17th at the 20 Years of Propaganda Conference, organized by the University of Windsor, Canada.
That's effective propaganda. And again, it's very much like Vietnam. So you go back to the Vietnam War, various debate. It was not about the question of whether the United States has a right to invade and destroy a country. Of course we do. That's a given. So you don't debate it. So it's not discussed in responsible circles. Rather, the questions that were discussed are the Russians interfering by providing North Vietnam with air defense? Is China interfering by rebuilding railroads, Chinese railroads that happened to pass through North Vietnamese territory that were bombing? Are the Vietnamese intervening by supporting indigenous resistance in South Vietnam, which always was the main target of attack? So that was the debate, always. Actually, even in the anti-war movement, I'm sorry to say, it was kind of accepted. That's what you debate. At the extreme end, within the mainstream, you get Arthur Schlesinger, Anthony Lewis, and so on. Well, another illustration is this very interesting concept of stability that I mentioned. I mentioned one example. It's a standard usage. Bush, number one, had to support Saddam's crushing of a rebellion that might have overthrown him in the interest of stability. In simple English, that means it's too dangerous to allow Iraqis to rule Iraq, and still is. Therefore, we have to impose stability, meaning subordination to U.S. rule. That's a definition of the word. A couple of days ago, there was a front-page headline in the press saying, U.S.-Iran set to confer on Iraq stability, that is, on inducing Iran to contribute to U.S. rule over Iraq in a stable client state, which we rule by right since we own the world. Not going to be a question. And nobody does. Well, given the technical usage, there's no contradiction when somebody writes, I'm quoting, that the United States had to destabilize a freely elected government in Chile because we were determined to seek stability. That's not a contradiction. Stability means subordination to U.S. rule, so therefore laying the basis for a murderous, vicious military coup, destabilizing it is the right thing to do in the interest of stability. That happens to be James Chase, liberal commentator, editor of Foreign Affairs in the New York Times. And it all makes sense. And therefore, it's a question on the unspoken but critical assumption that the United States owns the world. You don't accept that assumption. You're just not part of civilized discourse. And again, it's never asserted. That would be a bad mistake, kind of like a totalitarian state. Just instill it by constant presupposition. We all agree, when it's somebody else, that invaders have no rights. They have no rights to make any decisions, whether to withdraw or not. They have responsibilities. Prime responsibility is to pay reparations for what they did. The second one is to hold the guilty accountable by the standards of Nuremberg. The third responsibility is to attend to the will of the victims, which then withdraw. In the U.S.-UK case, it would be the same if we were willing to accept the most elementary of moral principles, namely Jackson's principle of universality, which is, of course, unthinkable. If we could, the responsibility would be to pay massive reparations. But going back to Saddam's takeover, it includes the sanctions and the wars, hold those accountable who sipped from the poisoned chalice, and attend to the will of the victims, which we know. Well, none of that's on the agenda. None of it's even discussable. And again, for the same reason that we own the world, the principle of universality is canceled. To bring it up would elicit either vilification or hysteria or more often just incomprehension, as if you're talking Swahili or something like that. Also, not discussable are the reasons for the U.S.-UK invasion. Undiscussable. and for the unwillingness to withdraw without securing a dependable client state. It's a remarkable fact in free countries in the West that all of this is off the agenda, just as comparable cases, comparable questions were in the case of Vietnam and elsewhere. It's a topic for another talk. Let's go back to Nuremberg and aggression. I mentioned one provision of the definition of aggression at Nuremberg. There was another provision. This is Justice Jackson again. An aggressor is a state that commits such actions as provision of support to armed bands formed in the territory of another state, refusal, notwithstanding the request of the invaded state, to take in its own territory all the measures in its power to deprive those bands of all assistance or protection. Okay? Uncontroversially and unambiguously, that applies, for example, to the Reaganite war against Nicaragua. So by the standards of Nuremberg, those responsible should have faced the death sentence. But that level of adherence to the principle of universality is far too unthinkable even to be mentioned without horror. So folks are not too horrified to mention it. Recall that Nicaragua did bring charges against the United States in the World Court. However, the court would not consider the charge of aggression. In fact, the court dismissed most of Nicaragua's case, which was presented by a distinguished Harvard Law professor, Caitlin Chase. The court dismissed it on the valid grounds that when the United States accepted World Court jurisdiction in 1946, the U.S. excluded itself from prosecution under multilateral treaties. That includes the U.N. Charter and the Charter of the Organization of American States. So it's impossible to bring charge for aggression against the United States. The court, same happened when Yugoslavia charged NATO powers a couple of years ago for the bombing. The U.S. immediately removed itself from the case, and the court accepted it correctly. The reason was that Yugoslavia had brought up the Genocide Convention, and when the United States finally ratified the Genocide Convention 4 years after it was established, there was a special provision saying it's inapplicable to the United States. So therefore, by law, the United States is immune to charges of aggression and genocide, and in fact, it extends far further. All of this would be taught in junior high school and societies that value their freedom. You might ask how many of you are familiar with it and draw the conclusion. Well, even on the narrow grounds that were permitted, the court restricted itself, had to restrict itself to customary international law and a particular bilateral U.S.-Nicaragua treaty. And even on those narrow grounds, the court did condemn the United States for unlawful use of force, which is its terror, international terrorism. It demanded that the crimes be terminated and that the U.S. pay substantial reparations. That was backed by two Security Council resolutions, which the United States vetoed, with Britain and France politely abstaining. The press reacted by dismissing the court as a hostile forum, New York Times editors, which is true, they condemned the U.S., so they're hostile forums, so you should pay attention to them. A couple of years earlier, the same court had been lauded for supporting Washington in a case against Iran. Congress reacted by providing substantial new funding for the war, a bipartisan vote. The U.S. command reacted by issuing orders to its mercenary forces to attack what it called soft targets. That means undefended civilian targets, and to avoid the Nicaraguan army, which the mercenary forces could do thanks to CIA control of Nicaraguan airspace and sophisticated communication equipment in the hands of the mercenary forces. That was officially approved by the State Department. Well, the war against Nicaragua was only one small part of Reaganite terror in Central America, which itself was only a small part of Reaganite atrocities worldwide. Remember, that's pretty much the government now in office. And the reaction illustrates another useful device of sophisticated propaganda systems. When you're caught committing, here's some advice for those of you who are going into journalism, when you're caught committing huge crimes, don't deny them. That's a mistake. That raises the issues for discussion and analysis, and then you're in trouble. What you should do is portray the actions as noble and magnificent, sort of shifting the grounds. Now, here's an example from Newsweek a couple of weeks ago. This one was brought up by Fair, a media analyst. I hadn't noticed it. They have a prestigious columnist, international affairs columnist, Fareed Zakaria, and he lamented that the Bush administration, the current one, has been intervening in the domestic affairs of Latin America. That is, they're going back to the bad old days, he said, which came to an end when, I'm quoting, came to an end when Ronald Reagan orchestrated an extraordinary turnaround supporting human rights, democracy, and free trade. I mean, the audacity is stunning, but that's the right kind of response when you're caught as a serial killer. How noble you are. You're reinstituting human rights, and it's not even know how to answer. Well, that's, the audacity is stunning. After the Reagan administration broke new records in intervention in support of vicious mass murderers from Argentina all the way up to the Central American killers and torturers who practically destroyed four countries and reached literal genocide in the Guatemalan highlands, accompanied by fulsome praise from the saintly Reagan. There's a minor fib in his comment that has to do with free trade. In reality, Reagan doubled protectionist barriers and organized state intervention to save incompetent corporate management from Japanese competition that was wiping them out. Well, the technique is common. Harvard University has a Center for Media Studies, Shorenstein Center, at the Kennedy School of Government. It's directed by a respected media leader, Marvin Cowell. Just recently, a couple weeks ago, they released a study. Cowell released a study of media coverage of the U.S.-Israeli invasion of Lebanon last summer. You really have to read it to believe it. I don't have time to go through it, but I urge it. According to Cowell's account, the United States media were pawns in the hands of Hezbollah. They covered up Hezbollah crimes, and they condemned Israel for aggression, as it was fighting a two-front existential war for its survival. I mean, the number of lies and malicious distortions per paragraph is stunning, sometimes even comical. So, for example, includes bitter condemnation of Middle East journalism, which does not accept their high standards of objectivity and is just a propaganda instrument. Biggest proof. The proof is a London-based Arabic journal that published 22 pictures of Lebanese civilian casualties, but only one picture of Israeli casualties. Now, the actual ratio of casualties was about 25 to 1. Okay, so by objective Western standards, you have equal numbers for the aggressors and the victims, not 22 to 1, understated, as in the corrupt Arabic press. According to Cowell, the wet U.S. media are almost as bad. On NBC, ABC, and CBS, three main channels, he writes that in the first 2 weeks of the war, there were 133 stories of Israeli attacks against Lebanon, 89 on Hezbollah attacks against Israel, which in the real world were a virtually undetectable, minuscule fraction of the Israeli attacks, and furthermore were in retaliation for Israel's immediate and very heavy bombing of civilian areas in Lebanon after the capture of two Israeli soldiers. And the capture of two Israeli soldiers means demonstrably precisely nothing by Western standards. Easy to prove. For decades, Israel had been kidnapping, often killing, Lebanese and Palestinians in Lebanon or on the high seas in transit between Cyprus and Lebanon, sometimes holding them as hostages for many years. Hundreds were sent to the secret prison torture chambers like Facility 1391, which is exposed in detail in Israel, reported in England on the continent, but never in the U.S. No one ever called for an invasion of Israel, and if they had, it would have been described as a reversion to Nazism. Well, this is just a tiny fraction of the pure cynicism of this. Actually, there is a response to Cal's extraordinary display of apologetics for aggression and atrocities. It's by Howard Friel. He's the co-author with Richard Falk of an outstanding book, which came out on the coverage of Israel-Palestine by the New York Times the last 6 years. This book is a follow-up to a devastating critique of New York Times coverage of a wide range of other issues. But those are two more books that are far too important not to review or to mention. You can search, but they're worth reading. Zachariah and Kalb, that device, is an interesting illustration of one of the favorite maxims of John Quincy Adams, the great grand strategist of American expansionism. One of his favorite authors was Tacitus, and his favorite maxim was Tacitus's statement, "Crime once exposed has no refuge but audacity." And it works in a deeply indoctrinated intellectual and moral culture. Well, let's turn to the next likely horror story, Iran. The world is aghast at the possibility of the U.S. or Israel attacking Iran. Iran's neighbors, Turkey, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, they don't like Iran, and they certainly don't want it to have nuclear weapons. But large majorities there, they prefer for Iran to have nuclear weapons rather than any military action. Well-known British military historian Corelli Barnett wrote a couple of weeks ago that if the U.S. attacks Iran, it'll be World War III. Iranians have been warned for years to take defensive action. Last couple of years, Israel has the largest and technologically most advanced air force anywhere outside, greater than any NATO power outside the United States. But the U.S. for the last couple of years has been sending them about 100 advanced jet bombers. They very publicly announced and declared to be capable of bombing Iran and returning. That's a warning to Iranians. Martin von Krefeld, leading Israeli military historian, wrote in the International Herald Tribune in Europe that, of course, he doesn't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. But after the invasion of Iraq, if Iran is not developing nuclear weapons, he wrote, they're crazy. And the United States informed the world that it's going to attack anyone it likes if they're defenseless. So it's an invitation to say you better build nuclear weapons. The Iranians are notified about the attack. The population here is kept in the dark. We don't know. The information has to be kept secret because of what's called security. If you haven't done it yet, I advise it's instructive to read through the record of declassified documents. They're open societies in the United States, at least. They get a lot of declassified documents. And they're interesting reading. Now, they are kept secret for reasons of security. Security against the primary enemy, the domestic population. Overwhelmingly, they're kept. The security has to be so that the population won't know what the government's planning. I mean, there's some legitimate security, but that's the bulk of it. And this is another case. They're going to tell us what they're planning. We're not supposed to know. Maybe the attack is being planned, maybe not. Could happen by accident. U.S. naval forces deployed in the Gulf, and it's almost like an invitation for some kind of accident. U.S. is sponsoring terror, almost certainly, inside Iran. Recently was reported from Balochistan, probably elsewhere. The likely area is Khuzestan. That's Arab area of Iran near the Gulf, which happens to be where the oil is. One of the, you can kind of guess without seeing secret documents, that some of the planning in Washington is to take over Kurdistan on the pretext of defending it from Iranian aggression. Then you got the oil, and you can carpet bomb the rest of the place. It's probably one of the plans, but we don't know. Maybe World War III. Well, is there an alternative? Yeah, there have been Iranian initiatives. In 2003, the Iranian government, with the support of the Supreme Leader Khamenei, approached the United States with an offer, which you can read. It was kept secret for years, but it's leaked, so you can read it on the internet now, so you know what it says. It called for negotiations on all nuclear issues, and also on a two-state settlement for the Israel-Palestine problem. And that continues. Khamenei, who's supreme leader, has again reiterated that Iran accepts the Arab League position on Israel-Palestine. That's call for normalization of relations with Israel along in terms of the long-standing international consensus on a two-state settlement that the U.S. has unilaterally blocked for 30 years and still does. The West loves Ahmadinejad. Every crazed statement of his is right on the front pages, you know, often mistranslated. But they don't like his superior, Khamenei, who happens to be in charge of foreign affairs, so Ahmadinejad has nothing to do with it. And whose statements are just too moderate, so you don't read them, part of the functioning of a good propaganda system. Well, let's go back to these Iranian offers. Do they mean it? Well, there's only one way to find out, and that's to explore. That's barred. The U.S. is apparently afraid that they do mean it. The 2003 offer, when it came to Washington, it did get a response. The Bush administration censured the Swiss diplomat who brought the offer and told him not to do that again. In 2004, the European Union nevertheless went ahead and did reach an agreement with Iran. Iran agreed to suspend enrichment of uranium, to which it's entitled as a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Everyone agrees on that. But they agreed to suspend it in return for for firm guarantees on security issues. Security issues means U.S.-Israeli threats to attack Iran. Well, U.S. would not permit the European Union to live up to its side of the bargain, would not permit them to give guarantees on security. The U.S. wouldn't attack. Then Iran withdrew from its side of the bargain, began enriching uranium again. Interpretation here is Iran broke the bargain. Can't trust it. The reaction has been to step up the threats. Actually, the threats are in violation of the UN Charter, if anybody cares, but that doesn't mean anything in outlaw states. Now, the Iranian government is pretty rotten, there's no doubt about that. But we might raise the question whether there are possibilities of peaceful settlement right now, fending off possible World War III. So let's imagine, I agree, this is kind of remote, but just imagine that the United States and Iran were functioning democratic societies in which public opinion influenced policy, a thought experiment. It's been carefully investigated by the leading institution that studies public opinion in the world, Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. You can find the results on their website. They have investigated both Iranian and U.S. public opinion. It turns out that they're almost identical. In both countries, large majorities, overwhelming majorities, agree that Iran should have the right to nuclear energy, like any signer of the NPT, but that it should not have nuclear weapons. By an even larger majority, they agree that the nuclear weapon states, primarily the United States, should live up to their legal obligation, and it is a legal obligation, to eliminate nuclear weapons. 82% in the United States are in favor of that. If you can't achieve that, a very large majority, almost the same, says that the region should be nuclear weapons free. Large majorities in both countries. That includes Iran, Israel, and U.S. forces deployed there. Overwhelming agreement. In the United States, 75% of the population think that the government ought to withdraw all threats, which notice are crimes, and turn to diplomatic relations and negotiations. Well, you know, if Iranians and Americans had any influence on the policies of the government, the crisis would probably be resolved. These are sensible outlines for resolution of the crisis. Well, we can do a lot to make our own countries functioning democracies. For example, countries in which all of this stuff is on the front pages all the time, so people can think about it and do something about it. That would be a functioning democracy. Now, we can't do it directly in Iran, but we can help. The best help would be to pay some attention to the dissidents, the reformers, the opposition groups, you know, people like Shirin Ebadi, the laureate, or Akbar Ganji. Popular organizations, most important are the labor organizations. Now, they're demanding an end to all threats against Iran, and for good reasons. They know, as we can all figure out ourselves, that the threats are just a gift to the hardliners. They rally support for harsh measures of repression. Now, we understand the mechanisms here. You know, it's a threat. Everybody, you know, huddles under the umbrella of power. It's a grant for repression. That's under vastly less threat than Iran is facing. Bush's axis of evil speech in 2002 predictably led at once to attacks against the dissidents as traitors. One Iranian scholar, Columbia, Hamid Dabashi, describes the axis of evil speech as the second most severe U.S. attack on Iranian democracy. The worst attack, of course, was overthrowing the parliamentary government by force in 1953. Well, we can act to open some space for those who are seeking to overthrow the reactionary and repressive theocracy from within, instead of undermining their efforts by threats and aggressive militarism, with bipartisan support, incidentally, in the United States, although opposed by the overwhelming majority of the public in the U.S. Well, in general, the world faces quite severe dangers. And much of the problem is right here in our intellectual and our moral culture and in the media that reflect and reinforce them. And actually, that's an optimistic conclusion. It means that we can do something about all of this if we choose.
You've been listening to the keynote speech by Noam Chomsky, delivered May 17th at the 20 Years of Propaganda Conference, organized by the University of Windsor, Canada. Due to time restrictions, 8 minutes of the audio were cut. The original speech and the Q&A that followed can be found at www.radioforall.net. Noam Chomsky's speech, The Poison Chalice, the Media, and the Use of Force, was edited for radio by CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.